We're going to go on to Appeal 12-1250 and 12-1251, United States versus Cureton.
May it please the court? Schnacki? Yes, Schnacki.
Schnacki. Mm-hmm.
May it please the court, my name is Kate Schnacki, and I represent the appellant, Thomas Cureton. And we're here this morning to discuss two issues. The first, the district court improperly admitted evidence of an uncharged armed robbery and drug transaction that was unrelated to any of the charged offenses in the underlying case. Additionally, the district court improperly applied two 924C sentences for one use of one gun in furtherance of a single criminal conduct. I'd like to begin with the first issue. The district court admitted testimony of Jeffrey Day, Everett Sacasco, and Lori Freese related to an alleged armed robbery that occurred on July 12, 2010. The armed robbery was unrelated to any of the charged offenses in the underlying case.
Why wasn't the robbery relevant to explain why Mr. Cureton very much needed the lost money and therefore would have reason to commit extortion in order to obtain the replacement funds?
Well, the government had argued that it was relevant to prove motive. But there's a couple issues with that. First and foremost, there's no evidence that this alleged robbery ever took place. There's no testimony that the $9,000 that Ashley Lawrence...
But isn't it a permissible and logical inference that the money came from the robbery?
Well, it's...
I mean, most people don't keep thousands of dollars in their freezer, for example.
Well, there's no evidence that there was the $9,000. And it doesn't. The government never explained why that would have... The fact that the $9,000 allegedly came from this alleged armed robbery, why that supplied an additional motive. It wouldn't would have made a difference if that $9,000 was earned another way. The facts surrounding that alleged armed robbery were so prejudicial compared to any probative value that they had that it should never have been admitted. Additionally, the testimony regarding that alleged armed robbery, there was testimony that Day, Sacasco, and Price were meeting Cureton for the second time during the day because they had previously purchased cocaine earlier that morning. That testimony was completely irrelevant to any of the issues with that trial. And the only reason it was admitted was to paint the picture that Mr. Cureton was someone who had a propensity to sell drugs.
You know, you don't have a whole lot of time, and I'd really like you to go on to the multiple 924C convictions based on the single use of the gun issue.
All right. As far as the ransom case is concerned, Mr. Cureton was convicted of count one of interstate communication of a ransom request and count three of attempted extortion. And counts two and four were related to the use of a gun in furtherance of those crimes. Now, the statute itself does not manifest an intention to punish a defendant twice for the continuous possession of a single firearm in furtherance of the simultaneous predicate offenses that consisted of...
Just to clarify, as you understand the facts, Mr. Cureton committed both of the predicate crimes here simultaneously?
Yes, Your Honor. With the two predicate offenses, and we admit that they are two predicate offenses, but they all arose out of the same conduct, which involved kidnapping Ashley Lawrence and picking up the phone and calling her grandfather and then demanding money for her release.
So the elements are different, but it's a single use of a firearm, right?
Exactly. And it was only one use of one firearm that was used in furtherance of those two predicate crimes.
In your brief and in some of the cases, they use this term unit of prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what you mean when you use that term or what the cases mean?
I believe it means what the court looks at to determine how many 924C convictions should be applied.
Does it mean predicate offense?
No, not necessarily. It's kind of split among the circuits, and the Seventh Circuit has yet to rule on this. Mm-hmm. And
lucky us.
And
so you're kind of explaining it with it's sort of a circular explanation. It's what the courts look at to decide what to attach the firearms offense to.
Yes, it is based off of the predicate. It is based off of the predicate offense. If that's what you're asking.
And here we have two predicate offenses. Are there two units of prosecution, or?
There are two predicate offenses that we've admitted. However, there was only one use of one gun in furtherance of those two predicate crimes. And quite frankly, those crimes were committed at the same time. They involve the exact same conduct. So for purposes of 924C, they really should be viewed as one criminal misconduct. And while the Seventh Circuit has not ruled on this issue, there is case law from the Seventh Circuit that kind of leads us to believe that the Seventh Circuit would look at it as a combination of both the predicate crimes and the amount of guns that were used in furtherance of those predicate crimes. For instance, U.S. v. Kappas, the court says that while a defendant cannot be convicted twice under 924C for using two guns in connection with the same drug trafficking or violent offense, separate convictions are permissible so long as the court's instructions require the jury to connect each gun use to a separate predicate offense. Now, we admit that the facts in Kappas are not exactly what we're dealing with here, but the language indicates that the court looks at whether each gun use is used to a separate predicate offense, so that the number of guns and the number of uses of guns is an important consideration in applying 924C. Additionally, other circuits have ruled that cases like this, where the conduct is simultaneous and it consisted of virtually the same conduct and same criminal motivation, regardless of the fact that there were two predicate offenses, only one 924C conviction should be applied. In U.S. v. Phipps, the defendant was convicted of carjacking and kidnapping, which, again, were two separate predicate crimes, but he used one gun in furtherance of both of those predicate crimes. And on appeal, the court dismissed one of their 924C convictions on the basis that the unit of prosecution would be a combination of both number of guns and the number of predicate offenses. And the legislative history of the statute leads us to believe that the statute is really intended to punish the use and the carriage and the possession of a weapon in furtherance of those crimes. It's not used, or it was not created to punish the underlying offense, in addition to the punishments that are already set forth and imposed by those predicate crimes. There's language in the legislative history that specifically states that the penalties in the amendment were not addressed to the base felony, and that the bill provides a separate and additional penalty for the mere act of choosing to use or carry a gun in committing these crimes. So there's a fair amount of evidence that supports, when applying 924C, the purpose of the statute is to punish the use of guns. And here in this case, we had one gun and one use of the gun in furtherance of committing those crimes. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. McGrath.
Good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court.
Excuse me, but will you please go right into that issue?
The 924, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a difficult issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just to clarify, do you agree that the predicate crimes at issue here took place simultaneously?
I do.
You do.
I do. Let me take you through what we were considering when the 924Cs were, when we decided there were that two were necessary here. When you look at 924C itself, the statute, and we do think this is a question of statutory construction, it prohibits using or carrying a firearm during and in relation to any crime of violence or drug trafficking. So when we looked at that, we saw there was one crime of violence for attempted extortion, and there was one crime of violence for interstate communication of a ransom, then we had two separate predicate crimes, which no one is suggesting otherwise. So we saw that there were two separate predicate crimes. Then we looked to Seventh Circuit precedent to see how they have determined this in the past. And in CAPAS, they talk about if there are two separate predicate crimes, then that's all you look to. In CAPAS, there was this language about...
How could we determine which one is the second or subsequent one? How could the district court do that? Because the extra penalty comes for the second or subsequent one.
Right.
If they're simultaneous, which one's second?
I would suggest that's why there's language second or subsequent in this case.
Well,
there's
which one's subsequent?
The subsequent covers if it happened at a different time. The second covers if it happens at the same time.
Well, but see, look, you're right to argue that we've taken the majority view that the relevant unit of prosecution is the predicate crime, you know, rather than the use of the gun. But as far as I can tell, we've never had a case in which the predicate crimes occurred simultaneously. So what is bothering me a lot, is what is the logic behind punishing twice what amounts to one use of a gun in furtherance of simultaneous predicate crimes? I mean, isn't the statute and the scheme of consecutive sentences meant to impose multiple penalties on the individual who decides multiple times to use a gun in furtherance of a crime? And I have to tell you, I think this is a terribly difficult issue.
I would agree with you completely, Your Honor. The government, when they were looking at this, when the PSR came out and said that they were subsequent, we looked at it and we struggled with it. You can see when you look in the sentencing, the judge struggled with it, but he came down on the point that, look, if I look at this statute, I look at the construction of it, I'm not talking about equity. He says that. I'm not talking about equity. I'm talking about what I see in the construction of it and what the Seventh Circuit has done so far. I have to determine that I don't have a choice here. That's what the Ninth Circuit came down on as well in their case law of it. Looking, they said that we don't see that ambiguity in this. The statute says for each crime committed, this happens. And that's what we put it on and decided that it wasn't at the U.S. Attorney's position to make that determination. It wasn't for the district court's position to determine. It had to come up to the Seventh Circuit to make
that determination. So we don't need to then, is it your position, we don't need to look at the intent of the statute, which it seems to me the intent of the statute is to provide punishment for use or possession of a firearm in addition to the punishment otherwise imposed on the predicate offenses. And here, as both my colleagues have said, there was only a single use of the weapon. So isn't the better reading of the statute that with only a single use, there should only be a single punishment, 924 punishment, particularly when, as Judge Tinder pointed out, you can't tell what subsequent. It was simultaneous.
I think that the statute worded the way it is doesn't suggest that. If you go, it doesn't show the ambiguity that you're looking for. I think once you look into this particular situation, which may not have been contemplated when they made it, that's where the ambiguity is created. But I don't think it's inherent to the language in 18924C.
So that ambiguity is created because of the two charges. And well, we just have to make the judgment as to whether or not we're going to go one way or another on this thing.
Right, Your Honor. I think that's what everyone was considering when this happened.
Okay. And there was no, I mean, at the time of the sentencing, I take it then the government didn't suggest to the court, since it was like a double punishment, well, you know, we know this is an unresolved question. We're not saying it's ambiguous, but we think that the government would be satisfied with just the 1924C addition.
No, Your Honor, we argued that our understanding of the statute said that two should be implied, but we understood that, and we said in other circuits they have they have said differently. We're not saying that's not a reasonable thing to do, but we have to put up what we think is necessary here.
I want to back you up to Judge Rovner's question a little bit. As I understand her question, she says that our circuit has decided that unit of prosecution is the predicate offense. Do you agree with that? I saw that term used in your briefs,
I agree. If you look at the progeny after Kappus, they have a couple of cases, including Curtis and White, that look and say actually a unit of prosecution is the predicate offense. Or they cite to other case law in other jurisdictions where it says the unit of prosecution is. That's what also gave us confidence that at least was where
I wonder why we use that term at all, then. If it's predicate offense, it's a lot easier and more direct and understandable than unit of prosecution.
It is, but because other circuits have done the hybrid one that the appellant suggests, which is you have to show use, one unit of prosecution is a use and a predicate offense, you had to create a term of art that was different than just predicate offense. So we were trying to use the language used by other ones to make it clear to the court. What we were trying to say was that in what we have seen so far from the Seventh Circuit is they're saying the unit of prosecution is a predicate offense. Others are saying it's different. We're going to keep we think that the court should follow what it has followed thus far. The only other thing I do want to add is the question of whether if one of these is taken down, we do believe that it has to be brought back to the district court to determine whether whether a sentence should be changed. You know, the first 924C is at a minimum a 7-year sentence. We think that the court could have come back if there was no second one and say, because of the circumstance of this case, because of the seriousness of the offense, it should absolutely have the ability to say that, yeah, in this case, because of the horrific things that happened, it should be more than 7 years. So we think that if you do take 924C away, that the court should have that opportunity to readdress the 3553 factors, taking that into account to see if a 37-year sentence is sufficient given the facts of that case. The only thing I would turn on the 404B question is that, everything in the record shows that this was motive. There was a limiting instruction that specifically said you have to look at this just for motive, nothing else. The jury obviously followed that because they dismissed one of the crimes on the drug crime case, so they were looking at the elements as necessary. And also that if there was any chance that they shouldn't have brought in, it was harmless error because the overwhelming unchallenged evidence on both of the counts. And unless there are any other questions, I will leave it there and ask that both the sentence and the convictions be affirmed.
Thank you. How much time? 2 minutes. Can you do it?
Sure.
Do I have to give you more time?
I can do it.
Seems unfair. Go ahead.
You know, counsel referred to U.S. versus Curtis to support the notion that apparently the Seventh Circuit uses the predicate offenses as the unit of prosecution. But the issues in Curtis were completely different with what we're dealing here. That really didn't even involve 924C. It involved a different provision, 924J, that involved a murder issue. So that's really not applicable to the issues here. And, you know, with the different circuits around the nation applying this, I mean, there are different interpretations. And I think what we've learned here that there are multiple reasonable interpretations of the statute because it is vague and it is ambiguous. And to that extent, the rule of lenity should be applied, and it should be applied in favor of Mr. Cureton. Resentencing is concerned, the government's correct that when part of a sentence is vacated, the entire sentencing package becomes unbundled. But here, while the drug case and the ransom case were consolidated at the trial level, they were not consolidated at sentencing. And the sentences imposed in the drug case are not part of the same sentencing package. And Mr. Cureton received the maximum authorized sentence for each count in the ransom case. And no remand is warranted in this case. Additionally, when the cases were consolidated, the order that joined the cases at trial did not join them for sentencing purposes. And the record doesn't suggest that the judge considered the two cases combined whenever he sentenced Mr. Cureton. In fact, the judge reminded the parties at sentencing that these were two separate cases. The Mr. Cureton was sentenced to an authorized maximum of 20 years for both the interstate communication of a ransom request and attempted extortion. And on remand, the district court could not make any adjustments to either of those maximum sentences. And if we want to go back real quick just to the issue of motive, while the judge did admit an instruction, a limiting instruction, related to this alleged armed robbery, you know, you still have to weigh the prejudicial effect against any probative value that it may have. And in this case, it was a consolidated case. One of them was a drug transaction case, and the other was a violent ransom case. And this evidence that was admitted was both violent and drug-related. So the prejudicial value is overwhelming. And the trial judge even admitted that it was, quote, as prejudicial as it could get. So if the, do you have any more questions?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thanks to both of you, and particular thanks, of course, to you, Ms. Schnacki, because you were appointed. And you and your cohort over there have done a wonderful job for your client. You really have. And you always do a great job for the government. It's really wonderful to see